This episode is brought to you by Groove Washer, the best record cleaners and protective sleeves for your vinyl collection. Ask for the Groove Washer from your local shop or go to groovewasher.com. Discount code VinylGuide10. And now, on with the show.
Well, hey everyone, welcome to episode 386 of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds, and today we've got an absolutely fantastic guest with us, sharing all sorts of information about the Australian pub rock scene, vinyl records, and more, Mr. John Brewster of The Angels, or Angel City, depending on where you came from. Now, The Angels are an absolutely massive band in Australia, huge influence to our very culture. They're very beloved down under, and in the U.S. and I think other parts of the world, they were known as Angel City, where they influenced a lot of well-known bands, and we'll talk all about that today. We also chat with John about the Angels' period at Albert Productions, working with AC/DC, the production duo of Vanda and Young, and making those early records on Albert's. We also talked to John about working with David Bowie, the live stage show of the Angels, the audience callback for Will I Ever See Your Face Again, and there's even a special message in there for Ray Davies. This is a conversation you do not want to miss. Oh yeah, and by the way, John and his brother Rick are the Brewster Brothers, and they're doing a tour of Australia playing songs from the Angels, as well as gearing up to do a few shows of Angel songs with a symphony and choir. Some absolutely magic shows coming up. Check out theangels.com.au for tickets and details. And finally, if you love the Angels and enjoy this interview, there are a ton of other interviews and episodes of the Vinyl Guide podcast available for free, awaiting your earholes, including episode 385 with Ross Knight of Cosmic Psychos. That's episode 385 of the Vinyl Guide. Steve Turner of Mudhoney, episode 384. Janie Hendrix of the Jimi Hendrix Estate, episode 377. John Foy, artist, label owner, and Australian music legend, episodes 340 and 341. Vifo Riccobono, executive of Australian powerhouse music label Albert Productions, episode 338. We even had the full band of Amel and the Sniffers, episode 301. Peter Frampton, episode 300, and lots more. Just follow the Vinyl Guide in your podcast app. It's totally free. Scroll, download, listen, and enjoy. And with that, let's get straight into our conversation with John Brewster of The Angels, Angel City, and the Brewster Brothers. All right, ladies and gentlemen, this week on The Vinyl Guide, we have one of the most beloved bands and band leaders that has come out of this country, Mr. John Brewster of The Angels and all sorts of other projects over the years. How are you doing today, John?
I'm great, thanks, Nate. How are you?
I'm doing good. I'm very much looking forward to these Brewster Brothers shows. And being here in Sydney, I mean, you guys are playing Sydney, Newcastle, South Australia. If anyone wants to see the dates, they're at theangels.com.au. But here in Sydney, I mean, how great is the Bridge Hotel?
Oh, I love it. It's it's like one of the last bastions of pub rock in the whole country. It's there's other great venues like the Charles Hotel in Perth, the Governor Hindmarsh in Adelaide, which we're doing with the Brewster Brothers Electric. But the Bridge has been there forever, and we love it. We, you know, when we play the Angels there, we do three nights and sell them out. The Brewster Brothers Electric would be a bit quieter than that, but it's just something that we wanted to do because, as you probably know, next year's our 50th year, which is a pretty big milestone. So, you know, we were just talking one day, and Rick and I were sort of saying, it's a shame we can't. There's so many songs that we've written over the years, we never get a chance to play. You know, because the Angels, it's like a hit show, you know, which is fine. You know, we're not complaining about that. And Dave Gleason's a wonderful front man, but he's also in the Screaming Jets. So when he goes out and does the Jets, we've got a bit of an opportunity to do something different. By the way, we'd also like having the break, but the break's good. But we just got talking about all these songs that we would like to play, and fans would like us to play, but we never get a chance to do. So Nick Norton, our drummer, happens to be a great front man in his own right. So he said, okay, we'll get somebody else on the drums. And in the New South Wales, it's my son, Tom. He's going to be playing drums. He's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And of course, my son Sam plays bass and has been for the last 12 years, I think, now. You know, the songs that fans love that we just never play. So things like Don't Waste My Time, Eat City, and some of them are actually, they were actually hit records. But, you know, most of the shows we do as the Angels, we're just playing, you know, all those Red Hot Summers and the shows we've just done over in New Zealand, which, you know, it's an hour show. This way we can have some fun and play songs that we actually love to play, but we haven't played for a long, long time.
Now, are you going to reach as far back into the earliest albums or even as far back as Moonshine Jug and String Band?
Well, I mean, I did write a song called Shelter from the Rain, which is on the first Angels album. Mm-hmm. So I think it's the first song I ever wrote. And people seem to like that song, so we might do that. We won't do too many from Face to Face, No Exit. A lot of the songs will come from that later period where there were some gems there, you know, like the last album that we did with Doc, for example, the Skin and Bone album. I think it's a great album. It wasn't commercially that successful, but, well, having said that, it's still, I think it went platinum, but it's actually a terrific album. So we're going to do Moving On, Invisible Man, and Call That Living from that album. You know, Don't Waste My Time. We'll do Dogs Are Talking. We'll do Let the Night Roll On. We'll do Get Out of This Place, which we just never do with Dave, you know. So It's going to be fun.
I can't wait for it. And, yeah, the sticky floor of the Bridge Hotel is a familiar feeling to the bottom of my boots. So,
yeah, and it wouldn't be a bridge show if you didn't sort of walk, before you walked on stage, you had to go to that little toilet at the back, you know, which is not the nicest smell. But anyway, it's the way it is. It's the way it is. You know, we play on huge stages when we do all these big Red Hot Summers, the shows we've just done in New Zealand. It's huge, and there's masses of people. And then you go into the Bridge Hotel and it's like postage stamp and stand and deliver. And we love it all, you know, we really do. You know, we're very lucky because we've been around all these years and we wrote all those songs. And we play today with as much passion as we ever did. You know, we just love it. We're very lucky. We've got a lot of fans and, you know, life's great. Well, I go away for a week and I come back home again. It's also balanced. In the old days, we'd go away for weeks on end, or when we started touring the States, you know, we'd go away for months on end.
So as you probably deduced, Australia isn't my native country. I grew up in the U.S., and in the U.S., you guys were known as Angel City.
Yeah.
Going back to that, the original name of the band was the Keystone Angels. If I recall.
Yeah.
Now, where did the name the Keystone Angels come from?
Well, it's just one of those things that I think we were having a barbecue or something, and somebody had written a whole lot of names, and the Keystone Angels was one. But we'd been a jug band, Moonshine Jug and String Band. And so when we did that transition to becoming an electric band, and basically we learned to play electric guitars by just doing it in front of people, making fools of ourselves sometimes. But anyway, it was a great way to learn to be, and you know, and it's always for us, the live thing is the most important thing that we do, playing to an audience. Keystone Angels, I reckon, came from Keystone Cops, the zany thing about the jug band where we, you know, used to go to op shops to get our clothing and stuff, you know, and you know, I did filmmaking and drama at Flinders University, and so did Doc Neeson. And we were right into things like the Marx Brothers and of course, the Keystone Cops and Mae West and W.C. Fields, etc. So I think when we started a rock band, that name, the Keystone Angels, kind of stuck. And then we met AC/DC in 1975, and we did three gigs with them in South Australia. We did Port Pirie, Whyalla and Port Augusta. Became great friends with them. They said they wanted to go back to Sydney and tell Harry Vander and George Young about us, which they did, true to their word. They were great guys. And so we were sitting with George Young one day, and George was an amazing inspiration, just amazing. And he would never tell you what you should do. He would just ask questions. Have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? You know. And one day he just said, have you got, matter of interest, why have you got that word Keystone in your name? And we went, oh, no, not, we're not precious. He said, because the Angels would be a great name. So we went, okay. So we, you know. And one day he said to us, have you guys ever thought about having your hair cut short? And, of course, we all had long hair and was like, oh, no, 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 no. He said, yeah, that'd be interesting, though. He said, because if you cut your hair short, you'd be the first band in Australia to do it. So we went, you know what, that's a good idea. He was just such an inspiration. I mean, musically, he was just a genius. I mean, he could inspire you by just talking, and he'd start making these grunting noises with this rhythm. You go, and you go, oh, that's a fantastic idea. And you go back, get the guitars out, and work out what he was talking about.
When George Young talks, people need to listen, I think. He'd be well advised.
There'd be no AC/DC without him, and they say that themselves. There'd be no Angels without him, even though he actually handed the production over to Rick and me. Took us out in the hallway one day, him and Harry, and he said, oh, George did the talking, as he generally did, and he said, we'd like to pull out of producing you. I was a little bit distressed because I thought they'd lost interest. So this was before the band sort of took off. Mm-hmm. He said, we've got other acts that have got that Vander Young sound, and we think you're developing something that we should let you, have your own, do your own thing. Mark Opitz will work with you, and we went okay, and then we produced Face to Face. So,
So going back to that now, the difference between the sound of the first album and Face to Face is quite significant. Mm. I mean, is that because of Mark and team? Like, what was that? The reason for that difference.
A couple of things. AC/DC are great friends. We used to hang out in the studio with them and vice versa when we were recording. We would spend a lot of time with those guys as friends, and we'd swap instruments sometimes, have a little jam session, and it was really great stuff. But when they moved overseas, Malcolm Young came up to me and said, do you want to buy our Marshalls?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yeah. Because we had Wasp amps, so they just weren't very good, so we bought their Marshalls, and instantly our sound changed, and very much for the better. And so it's a combination of that, and then as we're out there on the road trying to, like hell, to get recognised by radio, we just started writing better and better songs. Mark Opitz was a terrific engineer. He was part of it too, because the sounds that we got were great. But in a sense, it was in particular Rick and me that drove all that a bit. Doc was a great part of it, co-writer with us. It's an evolution. A band evolves. If you're lucky, it evolves into something successful, and then you've got a career.
The guitar sound, absolutely, especially on Face to Face, it does remind me of that classic, you say AC/DC sound, but it's that Vander Young to me, because I always thought that their fingerprints were all over that particular guitar sound. Is that fair, or?
Kind of it is, because, it's hard to pin it down exactly to what happened. But the thing is, what we were around, we were part of a family. And I think it was one of the great tragedies of our whole career that our manager pulled us out of that record company. And when we started touring America, we'd lost that home base. I don't regret it. It's just the way things go. But, and we've had a wonderful career. But back in those Albert's days, things like guitar sound, we were influencing each other, I know Malcolm was a fan of the way I played, and I was a fan of the way he played. We'd sit in hotel rooms and with two guitars and just trade ideas. I look back on that and I think just how precious those memories are. because, you know, they evolved into one of the great bands ever. They always were, actually, right, even back then. You know, and we did all these gigs with Bon Scott, who was just, to me, the greatest rock singer in the world. I think, you know, him and Paul Rodgers and John Lennon, are pretty hard to beat those guys.
Now, did you spend much time – now, Albert's studio, I think, was on King Street, if I recall correctly.
Yeah.
Did you spend a lot of time just kind of hanging out there when you weren't recording, like watching AC/DC record or other bands, watching George and Harry produce other stuff?
Yeah, to a large extent. Particularly AC/DC. We didn't sort of – we weren't really there. Oh, well, John Paul Young sometimes. I remember Rick and I used to go to the studio and we'd often go after a gig. We'd play the Bondi Lifesaver and get out of there at 1 o'clock in the morning, go straight to Albert's, and we'd spend the night recording. That's where things like the Take a Long Line guitar solo came from. I started playing a chord progression that was nothing to not related to the song itself. You know, the song's in A major. I went to G and then C, C minor, G, B minor, etc. And we started singing the solo. And so Rick, you know, we just started singing that. Rick learned it on the guitar, and it's become one of the classic guitar solos that he's ever done, you know. But anyway, about 3 o'clock in the morning, I was walking through the corridors and literally bumped into Harry Vander, who was walking the other way. And he said, "Oh, John, have you got a couple of minutes?" And I said, "Sure." He said, "I think we might have a song." So we went down in the lift. Down on the third floor, there was a little Studio C, I think it was called Studio 3, which was like a cupboard of a studio. So it was like this little, we walk in there and there's this quarter inch tape that's going right around the room. And it's all held together with blue tack and pencils up through. And when you hit play, it went right? Which I think was George Young playing the drums, but it was on a loop. And they hit play and Lovers in the Air came out. 3 o'clock in the morning, I heard Lovers in the Air with Harry Vander singing it. I said to them, "That's not John Paul Young. That's not JP Wild singing. Who's singing there?" And Harry, looking bashful, he said, "Oh, that's me. It's just a guide vocal." I said, "It's brilliant." It was.
Oh, that is an amazing moment.
Yeah, it was.
I guess their sessions went all night, it tends to be. Like, they started work at like 6 p.m. and tended to go through to the morning. Is that kind of the rhythm that they had?
Well, yeah. I mean, often, I don't think it's all the time, but often they would do that. And so would we. Yeah, I mean, we were young and you could do that.
The energy,
but those days are very, very special, and it's you know, I'm still. I mean, I remember when George called me when our manager decided that we were not going to be with that record company anymore. I went in and had a meeting with them, and they were quite emotional about it. That, you know, we were great friends, and suddenly we were going to be on the outer. We did the Back in Black tour with AC/DC, even though we were no longer with Albert's, but. That was a wonderful tour, and we never lost the personal relationships. But I think our manager was not welcome in the building.
Yeah, well, even to this day, FIFA speaks very highly and beloved of the Angels. So, it seems to be that you parted as business associates, but you stayed friendly with everyone.
We've stayed friends, but FIFA's wonderful. I can tell you a story about FIFA when the band started to go through the roof, and we were just like jam packing people into venues back in before the days of all the fire restrictions, etc. And we were playing, I think it was called Bananas down in St Kilda. I think I'm right in saying that, but anyway, it was a very male dominated, quite heavy audience, and we're playing, and the place was jam packed, and then I see this commotion, and there's FIFA elbowing great big burly guys out of her way like this. And she just elbowed her way to the front, right down in front of us, and she's rocking out to the band. And I'm thinking, that's our A&R person. How fantastic.
So that first Angels album, at what point did you understand that there was an issue with the name The Angels?
Yeah, when we signed to Epic Records, we were told that there was a band in LA called Angel. It was one of these hair bands, you know, the all blonde hair with exactly the same length, and they get in the middle and wave their heads about like this. They're flowing, you know, like a glam band. Fucking awful. But anyway.
I always saw Angel albums in the cutout bin. That's what I remember about the band Angel.
Yeah, it was a bit caricature. And I shouldn't say this, I suppose, being really nasty, but I feel like being nasty because we couldn't be our name. So we just went, okay, so what are we going to call ourselves? You know, because they took out an injunction. Mm-hmm. So legally, we couldn't be the Angels in America. So somebody came up with Angel City. We never really liked that name, although actually, in retrospect, I don't actually mind it so much now. And I remember when Mike McCready was in Australia from Pearl Jam, he's a huge Angels fan, and he was asking people where he could buy Angel City records, and people would go, Angel City, who are they, you know? And then when the penny dropped, oh, the Angels, and he went and bought all our records. And so, yeah, there's always been that little bit of confusion, but that's okay, you know.
Was there ever a conversation about calling everything Angel City or even going back to the Keystone Angels or picking even a different name?
Oh, there may have been discussion about it, but we wanted to keep the word Angel in the name. Keystone Angels, we never really liked very much. I don't even know why we ever called it that, but it's because of the jug band, because, you know, the jug band was this kind of zany 1920s kind of thing, Keystone Cops and all that stuff. So, yeah, so no, we didn't really want to go to Keystone Angels, but Angel City, it's okay. Yeah.
And that's where I first learned of the band. And again, and you mentioned Pearl Jam. There's a lot of bands, particularly in the Seattle, you know, Pacific Northwest geography, that were really inspired by the Angels or Angel City. What are some of the artists that you've been, I guess, delightfully surprised to know that we're fans of the Angels' music?
Well, I'm told that Dave Grohl saw us. He was 14. He went with his dad to our Paramount Theatre show. Now, I can't confirm that, but I'm told that that's what happened. I mean, that sounds very plausible. I'm told that Kurt Cobain referenced us one time when he was in the studio, wanted to get a similar guitar sound or something. Mm-hmm. I'm told that. I can't confirm it, but that would blow me away. You know, Dave Grohl, how fantastic he is. Of course, the guys in Guns N' Roses, I mean, they used to play Marseille and Take a Long Line, and they're major fans. And I was actually having a text conversation with Slash just recently. I was playing golf between shots, and I'd hit my shot and the phone would go, bzz, and I go, oh, Slash. I'd do an answer to him and then go and play the next shot and back and forth. Unfortunately, I think they wanted me to come up on stage and do Marseille with them, but because of COVID, I wasn't able to. It was a tight thing. So, but I mean, next year, yeah, we might do something with Slash. And you know, great guitar player, great guy, you know. I've never met him personally, but the texting thing was good enough. That was great. Yeah.
Well, you know, some other fans of yours are coming into town in the next month or so. Mudhoney. Apparently Dan Peters has seen Angel City multiple times as a youngster. Maybe even some of those same shows that Kurt allegedly has
really?
Seen. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Wow. Oh, I better look out for him.
Yeah, we just had him on the show, and Steve Turner was talking about the influence of Angel City on them. Now, the Pacific Northwest, there was a – and I got this out of the Kicking Down the Door documentary. There was a radio station out of Portland, KGON, that really embraced Angels early on. So I kind of took that to mean that was ground zero for why there was so much influence in that region.
It was a huge part of it. KGON had a kind of radio station back thing where you could go and see a band for a dollar or something, or 99 cents. I think it was part of their call. It might have been KGON 99 or something. I can't remember. But for 99 cents, you could see it. So all of a sudden, we're playing to a big crowd. We also did the Kinks there and knocked people out. But that whole West Coast, when we did those Kinks shows, were fantastic. So fantastic that that Ray Davies kicked us off the bill. We did. But anyway, we never got across the East Coast because he was pretty paranoid. When we did the LA Forum, he actually personally went up the mixing desk and pulled our sound down.
So Ray Davies is a listener of the show. So any special messages for him?
Yeah, get fucked.
No way, get fucked.
He was not. And I'm actually a big fan. I love the Kinks. I mean, those records in the 60s, you know, were just wonderful stuff. So I'm a big fan. But he was just so offhand with us. He couldn't get a time of day out of him, you know. And we're not used to that. We've toured with, you know, like we did the whole Australian tour with David Bowie and had dinner with him every night. I mean, it was wonderful, you know. And he loved the band and, you know, and in fact, when we did the Bondi Lifesaver, he and his band came to the gig. They were right down the front, you know, where we call it the punter barrier. We've got the punter barrier and 1,800 people just jammed in there. And then we were in the first song, which was After the Rain, and David Bowie and his whole band come and they spent the whole night just down in front of us. And I'm pinching myself going, really?
Does that make you more nervous or does that bring out another level in you?
I don't know. I mean, those days we were just hell-bent. I mean, it made me very excited to think that, you know, not only are we doing all those gigs with them as the opening act, and they billed us as special guests, you know, so it wasn't like the normal support band thing. We were special guests, very respectful, very nice guy. We, you know, as I say, we had dinner with him and his band. Rick became really good friends with Adrian Ballou, who showed him some stuff that Rick still uses today. And AC/DC, when we did the Back in Black tour and all those shows that we did with Bon Scott and the band back in the 70s, you know, that they never tried to sort of, you know, I mean, they had their special lights and stuff, but basically we had the whole production. Mm-hmm. So it was a level playing field. So that they would never dream of turning the sound down because they knew that the better we went down, the better they were going to go down. Yeah. And that's our attitude too. We love it when a support band goes down great because it just makes the whole evening better. You know, we're now so established that we've got all the hits and Ray Davies had all the hits. We were just a new kids on the block, I suppose. But so there was a time when he was in Australia and we had finished up on, we were on the same plane, it was an Ansett plane, and our bass player Chris Bailey got the girl to give us to get a tray and put a dirty glass with a used lemon and sort of ice that had melted. And Ansett letterhead and he wrote to Ray Davies, courtesy of Angel City, and had her deliver it to him down in the front. And he wasn't happy, but we were.
there's that song, Will I Ever See Your Face Again? And
yeah,
coming to Australia, when I started hearing this song in the pubs, there was the callback chant. No way, fuck off. And I had to have someone explain it to me because it just seemed to come out of nowhere. And I guess the more I kind of look into it, it seems like that was just a very organic thing. What is the backstory of that callback?
We'll be back after these messages.
Hey everyone, I'm here to talk to you about Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Ever find a record in a used bin where the vinyl is gorgeous, but the sleeve has this ugly split and is even falling completely apart? Well, that's okay. Grab it anyway, because with Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips, you can fix that right up. Seems Easy record repair strips repair seam splits from the inside, so it doesn't affect the appearance of a record sleeve, but it does make it functional again. With Seems Easy, records can
now slide in and out like new.
Turn a $5 record into a $25 functioning collectible.
Just ask your local record shop for Seems Easy strips, and if they're not in stock, go to seemseasy.com. That's Seems Easy with two Z's. Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Seems easy because it is. Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE. 10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits.
There's that song, Will I Ever See Your Face Again? The callback chant. No way, yeah. Get fuck off. What is the backstory of that callback?
Yeah, well, we have no idea. We don't know how it happened. When you think that thing spread like a wildfire around the country, back in the very early 80s, where there was no mobile phones, no social media, no internet, there's nothing, you know. So, I mean, back in those days, you kind of queued up at phone boxes to call your loved ones, you know. It was ridiculous. Mm-hmm. When Face to Face and No Exit did so well, you know, and the Darkroom album, I mean, you know, the band was, you know, like a major band. I mean, there was a point there we were the number one band in the country. And so we went, just leave that song out. You know, it was our first single. It's a bit old hat now, you know. Mm-hmm. It's a bit of more of a boogie rock and roll song. It's not quite in the same, you know, bag as what we're doing now. So we left it out of the set for about 2 years. And then we were up at Mount Isa, which, of course, is a very isolated community. And it was the first time we ever played Mount Isa, and there were like 3,500 people in the town hall, and they were going crazy, you know, and they kept calling for encores. So after about the second encore, we were back in the dressing room, and there's still no one would leave, you know. So one of us said, why don't we play Face Again? So we go out there and we did Face Again. 3,500 people chanted, "No way, get fuck off." And we just went, what the hell was that about? Because we had no idea. And just we decided, why don't we just put the song in the set now and just see if that happens again? So we worked all the way down the east coast of Australia, went across to Perth, into Melbourne, Adelaide, Melbourne, back to Sydney, where we were living at the time. And everywhere we played, the audience chanted, "No way, get fuck off." Now it's become so huge that the song itself has become huge. We get approached almost weekly for it to be in some movie or whatever. It's fantastic. And I just think, well, okay, the song was actually written about a girl that died in a car accident, but if they want to go, "No way, get fuck off," that's Australia. That's the larrikin sense of humour. That's what producers, you know, Living Next Door, Alice, who the fuck is Alice? Or something. That's what they do. And it's not up to us to complain about it. It's fine. I think we'd be in big trouble if we didn't do the song these days.
Oh, yeah. I noticed the set at Narara, which is a legendary set, didn't have that song in it. And so that must have been within those years where you weren't playing them live.
Yeah, well, see, that was 1983, and it, you know, the song wasn't that big a deal for us at the time because of all the other stuff we were doing, you know. And but now, you know, you recognise that, you know, we're not unlike any other band that's had success. That and I don't want to compete on a level playing ground, but you know, I went to see the Rolling Stones. So Sue and I went to the Adelaide Oval. Actually, we got offered the support, but we weren't able to do it. But we went to the show, and I'm not interested in their new stuff either. I'm sure it's brilliant. But, you know, you grow up surrounded by the Rolling Stones songs, the Beatles songs. Bob Dylan was the big deal for me. He was the main big deal for me. But the Rolling Stones, all that's a great music. So you go and you want to hear those hits. So yeah, we recognise all that, you know, that we still create, we still write new songs, and some of them I think are fantastic. I'm proud of them, but they'll never become our big songs.
No, that's understood. Because that callback, it sounds like it was almost a virus that spread without the band even knowing.
How did it get around? I mean, you know, like, it's word of mouth.
Yeah,
it has to be, like you say, a virus, but it's not an internet virus, because that form of communication didn't exist. So
yeah,
somebody said, I think it started on a cruise ship. And I can believe that, because what happens on a cruise ship? People come from different towns and they're on a cruise ship and they go away and do their cruise and then they go back to their town. So if it happened on a cruise ship, then maybe that's, I don't know.
All viruses spread because of cruise ships. I think that's what the...
Yeah, including the wrong virus. Yeah, the COVID virus.
Does it happen to overseas audiences as well?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I left the band for a while. I know Rick and the band did a gig in, I was either Nashville or New Orleans. And yeah, the audience did it and that there as well. There were probably a few expats.
Mm-hmm. Leading the church.
Yeah, but you know, it's kind of weird in a way, because it's such a big thing that I can check into the airport. And I put my guitar down and the girl might say, oh, what's in there? I say, oh, they're guitars, you know, because I've got this big case. I can take some really special guitars in that case now, because I think you could go to war with this case, you know. Anyway, and she says, so what, are you playing a band or something? But no one ever believes that, because look at me, you know. Anyway, I say, yeah. She said, what band? I say, oh, the Angels. And she said, the Angels? No, don't know that. I said, do you know a song called Am I Going to See Your Face Again? And she said, oh, yeah, I know that. Well, that's our song. And, oh, wow. They all know the song, even if they don't know the band. But fortunately, a lot of people still do know the band, and we're doing really well. So,
yeah. Does the band have, do you and your brother, and I guess the Angels business entity, have control of the tapes and the music and the history of the Angels?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, Rick and me, yeah. Yeah. So there was some heated discussion about stuff like that. People who left the band decided we couldn't be in the band anymore. I was like, you've got to be kidding. You know, we started the band. So there was a little bit of argy-bargy going on there, never in a legal courtroom or anything, but we could never quite understand that. If people don't want to be in a band, well, stop the ones that want to continue. But anyway, that's what happened. But, yeah, we own it all now, and I care less about the ownership. Well, I do care about the ownership, but what I care mostly is that we're still a really good band. You know, we've got my son Sam playing the bass with us, and Dave Gleason's been with us now for 12 years. He's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And we're doing Brewster Brothers Electric, which is another thing I'm really looking forward to doing.
Absolutely. So a lot of what we do here on the show is we talk about some of the records and the collectibles. And in the Angels' very rich history, there's quite a few of those. Now, the album, The Angels, the very first one on Albert, what's the story of that album cover, the two faces? Is that Doc, or who is that on the cover?
Yeah, it's not Doc, but I can't remember the name of the artist that did that. But and it may actually have inspired the Face to Face title, because those two guys are face to face. But then again, it also might be a song that I wrote called Marseille, where I sing vis a vu, which is face to face to you. Mm-hmm. And that's on the Face to Face album. So I might have come from that. But I can't remember exactly where that album cover came from, but I look at it now and I think, you know, it stood the test of time. It's a good cover.
But yeah.
I can't really honestly remember too much about. I think there was just a number of different things that were presented to us by FIFA. and we just liked it.
Do you recall the story of the cover of Face to Face?
Yes, I do. At that stage, Doc had, you know, this evolving thing of a band, you know, where we started writing better and better songs. I Ain't the One. I wrote that song and presented it to the band. We all got excited because it had the Nick guitar thing, and so we started finding our musical identity. And Docker, who'd studied drama at Flinders University, as I did too, he went up to Professor Wol Cherry, who was the head of the drama department at Flinders University, and he had a chat to Wol, and Wol made this suggestion to him that he dress himself up as like an aristocrat, you know, and then dishevel through the performance. So he brought that element of drama into the whole thing. And that first outfit that Doc had with the ascot tie and the, you know, the gentleman, you know, the crazy gentleman.
Yeah.
Got represented on that cover by I can't remember the name of the artist, but the Doc coming out of the mirror and then the back side of it is disappearing into the mirror. We just thought that was brilliant, and I still do. It's great. But it was very much related to that whole sort of sense of drama that was going on with our live shows at the time. Ray Hawkins was doing our lighting by then, and we the lighting was very stark, and there's a lot of shadows, and we were very much into the theatre of expressionism, like Bertolt Brecht kind of stuff, you know. There was that element of, there was the element of art mixed with rock, you know, which is always a good thing.
Yeah, as a youngling, I don't think I picked up on that, but watching the documentary, it really underlined the point of how important the theater was. The lighting really, you know, it wasn't just typical rock band lighting. How choreographed were those shows?
Yeah, pretty much so, because in those days we would tour the whole country with the same production. So we take our light show with us. These days you can't do that. But Ray Hawkins, our lighting guy, was also a very, very close friend, still is, to Rick and me. And we'd go around to Ray's place. We physically built a whole lot of lights, the rain lights, and we'd set them up on trees at like 4 o'clock in the morning. And the whole idea of that, the rain lights, was for the No Exit album, to create an impression of prison bars. So when they came on and all the rest of the lights were turned off, it looked like Doc was behind a prison, you know, like, and he would go across, like, trying to get out, you know. So that sort of aspect, that, you know, was a big deal for us. It's different now. It's, you know, but and of course, that's also a band trying to establish itself and stand out from the crowd to be a bit different. You know, we're the same record company as AC/DC. We wanted to have our point of differences.
Because when AC/DC spilled out onto the stage, it was just they're running back and forth. It seemed like in the moment energy. And where Angels, they also had that in the moment energy, but there were also points within the live show to where it's like, okay, Doc will have the most effect here. There's the John Brewster guitar cutout over here. You know, there were a few points in that, but then there was enough room for the improvised chaos to occur as well.
Yeah, we were totally into it. You know, we'd talk about all that stuff, particularly with Ray Hawkins, because Ray was just so creative. And they're wonderful memories, really wonderful. And as I say, in those days we would go out with a semi-trailer full of stuff, and so you'd have the same production every night. But you can't do that now. But we don't need to, and we don't need to, you know, basically we're at a point now where the name of the band is a huge deal, and the repertoire is a huge deal, and you know, and we play it pretty well, you know. And I think it's probably important that Rick and I are there, but if it so happens that either one of us or both of us can't be there, we've got plans there too. I've got sons that could just take over.
Yeah, you're breeding bandmates.
Yeah, they're really good. I mean, you know, my son Sammy plays bass in the band. I mean, if Rick can't be there for some reason, which actually did happen in COVID, we did a show where Rick Sam just stepped up the plate and played all Rick's solos. And no one can play Rick's solos, but he can. So that's why I say, Rick, you better be careful. You better watch out for yourself.
There is the live album, Liveline, and there was a show, as I understand it, the Metro in Sydney, that was professionally filmed. Has that been released, or do you think that will be released?
I don't think so. I don't think that had. I don't know. That may have been a show that was done when I wasn't in the band. Because I left the band in the beginning of 86 and rejoined in 93. But I know that we did the Metro and recorded it when we did our Lounge Lizard thing where we played acoustic, just acoustics. The loudest acoustic band in the world, I think. Yeah. That's ridiculous. we had Angry Anderson and Ross Wilson with us on that tour. I don't think that was filmed. It was recorded. So anything that was filmed at the Metro, I'm not that aware of.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
My favourite film of the band, Narara is great, but apart from that, my favourite is the one we did in 1979 at La Trobe University, and that was just before we started touring the world. And that's, I think that's called This Is It, Folks, or something. That's really good. I mean, the band's are flying in that. That was the original lineup with Buzz Bidstrup, Chris Bailey, Rick and Doc and me. So that's a bit of a favourite for me.
When it comes to the Angels catalogue, you said you have all the tapes. You know, it can be revisited, or, you know, that's certainly within your control. Has there been any consideration of reissuing some of these on vinyl? For example, Liveline. I think that was only released on vinyl once.
Yeah. We're signed to Mushroom, Good Liberation, now called Bloodlines. They have now released Darkroom. Limited edition Darkroom on vinyl. I think that sort of thing is probably going to increase because there's more and more of a market, if you like, for vinyl. And we all know that vinyl sounds better than anything else. Mm-hmm. Can't beat it, you know.
Oh, 100%. Well, a lot of the Angels albums are very collectible, especially ones that were released in the earlier part of your career. To make it this far and not be damaged, not have had bong water spilled on it or have, you know, various parties is exceedingly rare. So I think that there's quite a few people out there that would be very interested in some reissues from the band.
Yeah, me too. I'll have to lean on Dean McLaughlin at Bloodlines. He's a great friend. He's a great friend. We love him. I think next year we should really seriously look at releasing some vinyl because we're celebrating 50 years, and when you celebrate 50 years, you're going back to the days when it was all vinyl. And, you know, I mean, God, they were wonderful days. When you made a record in those days, the amount of angst, okay, what are we going to open this record with? What's going to finish side one? And when you turn it over, what's going to open that? And then what's going to finish the whole record? And you know, you take it light and shades, right? You know, the whole thing's a trip, you know. These days you make a record and somebody might pick up one of the songs and it's streamed on Spotify or something and that's about it.
Yeah. So,
but you still do that whole process. You know, we still make albums and we still, you know, worry about, you know, how the sequence goes and all that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's important. And I would imagine, you know, a lot of thought and care and perhaps even constructive arguments about how best to sequence a record, how to present it as one piece, because that's how it used to be consumed.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that's the whole thing. And I miss those days. It is what it is now, but I certainly miss those days because, I mean, just even the physical size of a vinyl album, you know. So your cover is this big instead of this big.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big deal.
So, okay, Brewster Brothers Electric shows. There's also an EP, as I understand, that's available of Brewster Brothers Electric. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the thing is, when we do something like this, we sort of do it all the way. So we went, okay, if we're going to do some shows as Brewster Brothers Electric with Nick singing, then let's go in the studio and represent that. So we went in the studio, and there's a Brewster Brothers song that Rick and I did for our album that's called Shadows Fall, called Lives mm-hmm. of Grace, which is we thought was really appropriate to do. And so we went in there, we did that, we did a take of Night Attack, which I always love as a great song, which we never do with Dave. Mm-hmm. And a 2-minute warning, Small Price to Pay, which is how we got that deal with MCA. That song did it. And then we went to LA and we recorded. We spent a fortune, like an absolute fortune, trying to recapture the demo of Small Price. We should have released the demo. That's how we got the record deal, and the demo was fantastic. And the end result is, to me, is not that good. But we had to go at that one, and it's fantastic. We really nailed it. And Moving On, which is from the Skin and Bone album, I think it's a wonderful song. So yeah, we went into Ricky Ray's studio in Melbourne. He mixes quite a few of our live shows now, and he's got a fantastic studio. We went in with Mick Skelton, who plays drums in the Baby Animals. Wonderful guy, wonderful drummer. And we nailed it. I love that EP. It's turned out great.
Now, are you considering doing more recording projects? I mean, not to get too far ahead of what's happening with Brewster Brothers, but, you know.
Yeah. I honestly don't know, Nate. It's like, I don't know, because, I mean, we're not trying to replace the Angels. The Angels is a big deal in our life and we love doing it. Mm-hmm. So we'll just wait and see. You know, we might just do what we've done and call it a day. And then again, with 50 years coming up, we might be able to incorporate some of this into that. I just don't know.
Any further thoughts or plans for additional recharged versions of albums?
Maybe so. I think I can't name the people, but we've got various people from overseas who put their hand up to maybe guests on an album that I can name one, which is Slash. God, this is my texting while I'm playing golf. Text, whack. He replies. And I go, we're thinking of doing an album next year. Do you want to be a guest on it? And he goes, yeah, what song? And I go, well, you choose it. And he said, what about Marseille? I went, yeah, okay. So, I mean, look, he's one person out of quite a number of overseas people who, you know, some of who you've mentioned. Mm-hmm. That have been influenced by us over the years. And, I mean, we became really good friends with Pat Benatar and her husband, Neil Gerardo. What wonderful people. Pat Benatar's lost nothing. She's fantastic, and so is he. I played golf with him. I do a lot of
business on the golf course.
Golf courses are great. Yeah. And I was thinking about Pat Benatar, and I was thinking, what song would – If she become, you know, she has said she would do it, but what song would it be? And I'm thinking, well, you know, Be With You would be a really good song for a woman to sing. And then on her live show, she does Helter Skelter.
Mm-hmm.
And she nails it. I mean, it's just great. The band nails it. It's just really great. And I'm thinking, you know what? Pat Benatar singing Mr. Damage would be amazing.
Ooh, okay.
Can you imagine that?
That would be
amazing. I mean, she can build it out. But, you know, like, who knows? I mean, these things, you know, you talk about these things and people say, oh, yeah, you know, we'll do that, you know. But there's a long way between saying that and it actually happening. So I really shouldn't even talk about it. But there's a fair few people that have put their hand up.
It's a lot of work and there's a lot of miles in between a lot of people. But, you know, the 50th, as you say, 50th is there. It's a good goal to have.
Yeah, you know, that's it. You know, that... to have friends, help us celebrate that milestone is great. And you know what we want to do, and they've agreed to it too. Have you seen the June Rats doing Am I Going to See Your Face Again?
Oh, I have not. No, I haven't seen their version.
Oh, you got to see it. Look it up, because they got Rick and I, they flew Rick and I over to Sydney, and we went to the Triple J studios, and it's filmed and everything. And there's this young band, the June Rats, and they're fantastic. They sent me a demo of their version of Face Again, and I just sat and listened to it and went, wow, this is great. Mm-hmm. So we went over there, and these two old buggers are playing guitar in the background, and these young people are doing the song. There's three girls and the three guys in the band, and they're just fantastic. And it's gone through the roof. It came in the top Triple J Top 100 at number 23. Wow. They call it Like a Virgin.
Yeah.
So it was the number one Like a Virgin for the year. And so I said to their manager, Maddie Wu, look, we're going to do this album. I said, how would you feel about we put this version on it? And they're very excited. And I think how appropriate that 50 years later we've got this young band doing that song.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're talking about leveraging musicians from around, ones you've inspired from various bands and even collaborated with in the past, but also these new bands. Right now, some of the music that's coming out of Australia with, like, are you familiar with, like, the Chats and Amel and the Sniffers and some of those bands?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, even...
I'm not that aware. To be honest, I'm not following the live music scene, you know, too much. I mean, you know... I guess I'm old-fashioned, but if I put a record on, it's probably going to be Blonde on Blonde or something, you know. I mean, Dylan does as much to me now as he ever did, you know. Mm-hmm. And even now he does one, you know, the most – I mean, have you heard Murder Most Foul?
Murder Most Foul. Dylan?
Look it up.
Okay.
It goes 17 minutes. It's worth every second.
Which album is that
if
on?
If I may say I'm not even sure. I think it's his last album.
Oh, okay.
I don't even know what the album's called, but that song, it's not even a song. It's kind of half talked, half sung, but it's about the, in a sense, it's about the murder of John Kennedy.
Mm.
But he brings in the whole 20th century into that, and it's just a trip.
Mm.
To listen to that song, you'd want to do this. Headphones and read the lyric at the same time. It'll blow you away.
I will do that this weekend.
Great.
So John, again, very excited about these Brewster Brothers shows, especially one at the Bridge. I know we talked quite a bit about that. That was my local for many years. So I'm very excited about that, that particular show. Yeah. Where else are you guys hitting? What else is happening with not only Brewster Brothers, but other projects?
Yeah, well, we do, with the Bruce Brothers Electric, we're going to Newcastle at After the Bridge, the Wickham Park Hotel in Newcastle, which I've never been there before, but I'm looking forward to that. Then a week later we do the Gov in Adelaide, which is a legendary, wonderful, wonderful venue. And then we're going to do the Mimo Music Hall in St Kilda the day after that. So they're the four Bruce Brothers Electric shows coming up. Byron Bay Blues Fest before that, a whole lot of shows. We're doing the Big Red Bash in Birdsville. We're doing the Monday Bash in Broken Hill. We're doing the Mount Isa races. They're big shows, big outdoor shows. But in June, we're doing two Symphony of Angels shows, which is with a 32-piece orchestra and 40-member choir. And that's one of the great experiences of my whole life.
Wow. Okay, this is June 23rd, Melbourne at the Palais Theatre, Symphony of Angels.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah.
And with a full orchestra.
Yeah, orchestra and choir. it's incredible. We've done seven of them now. And Rob John, who's the conductor, is also the composer of just about all of the orchestral parts to our songs. So we've got stuff in there like Dawn is Breaking and Outcast and stuff. So it's not just a hit show. It's a really interesting show. It's had wonderful reception. We've actually got it out on DVD, that one.
Incredible.
With the Adelaide Symphony Orchestra.
Okay, so there's two dates of that, June 23rd in Melbourne and June 30th in Adelaide. So folks can get information on these gigs, the orchestrated ones, as well as Brewster Brothers at theangels.com.au. There's a little gigs link that you can go down and purchase tickets to see John and crew. Again, John, thank you so much for coming on The Vinyl Guide. It's been an absolute honor.
Thank you.
The band and your contributions are so beloved to my adopted country here and beyond. And again, I want to encourage folks who may not be as familiar with Angels or Angel City, go online, check out some of the live gigs. Narara is a great one. There's also the This Is It Folks that I believe is available that people can see. Make sure you check out theangels.com.au. Again, John, thank you so much for coming on The Vinyl Guys. Absolute honor.
Great pleasure, Nate. Lovely to talk to you.
Oh, man, what an absolute legend. John Brewster, the Angels, Angel City, and the Brewster Brothers. Make sure you see them on their tours. There's a bunch of really killer shows coming up. You can find more all about them, all the details and tickets available at theangels.com.au. And that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please share these episodes on your social media. Put them on Facebook, tweet them out on Twitter. That is always helpful. Find some music forums on Reddit or Facebook groups to go ahead and drop these into. Share with your friends. Show your buddies how to use that smartphone of theirs to dial up a podcast. That is always appreciated. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some music, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.